Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Ever find yourself maybe buying something totally illogical? You know, like that fancy gadget you swore you didn't need, and then you just stand there thinking, why? Why did I do that? If that sounds familiar, well, this deep dive is definitely for you. Today, we're really getting into the nitty-gritty of how our minds work using Jonathan St. B.T. Evans' really important book, Thinking and Reasoning.
Yeah, this book is, it's foundational. It's not just describing what we do. It's kind of like the user manual for the brain. It tackles that huge puzzle. How are we humans so brilliant sometimes? I mean, space travel, right? But then so predictably irrational and like, basic everyday choices.
Right.
So this deep dive, we're going to give you the framework Evans provides, the dual process theory, to really understand that.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because, yeah, this isn't just some dry academic thing. It's about understanding these two sort of operating systems that are constantly running, sometimes even fighting, inside your head.
That's a really good way to put it. And the person who really helped define these systems is Jonathan St. B.T. Evans. He's an emeritus professor, cognitive psychology, University of Plymouth. But what's really important, I think, is that he wasn't just commenting on this theory. He was actually one of the main architects. He helped build it.
Yeah, he's the real deal, a foundational researcher. Like, he didn't just read about the famous Wasson selection task. He actually developed different versions of it, ran the experiments. He's one of those rare people who can talk about reasoning because he spent decades actually testing how our minds work and, you know, where they go wrong.
Exactly. And that gives him this really distinctive viewpoint. He sort of moves past that older way of thinking, the one that just labels thinking as good or bad, you know, rational versus irrational. Instead, he pushes for what he calls ecological rationality.
Ecological rationality. Okay, what does that mean?
It's a bit of a game changer. It's the idea that our fast, intuitive thinking, the gut feeling stuff, it's often incredibly adaptive. It makes us efficient in the real world, even if technically those quick decisions break the strict rules of formal logic.
Wait, hang on. So you're saying our mistakes, our cognitive biases, they aren't necessarily bugs. They might be features, like survival hacks.
Yeah.
Sometimes ignoring logic is actually smarter.
In a way, yes. From an evolutionary perspective, they can be seen as features adapted for survival. That's his angle. And that whole reframing, that's central to the book, Thinking and Reasoning. It really serves as this comprehensive guide to the dual process theory, explaining how we think, why we make errors, and maybe what being rational really means today.
It sounds like it takes you on a bit of an intellectual journey then. Where does he start us off?
Well, he starts by kind of dismantling the old logicist view. For ages, the benchmark for human thinking was basically perfect logic, like some ideal robot. When experiments kept showing people didn't meet that standard, the conclusion was sort of, well, humans are flawed, broken reasoners. Evan says, hold on, maybe it's not one broken engine. Maybe it's two different systems interacting. That's the dual process model. It's much more psychologically realistic.
And it covers a lot of ground, right? Not just abstract logic.
Oh, yeah. The book goes deep into deductive reasoning, that's the pure logic stuff, but also inductive reasoning, how we make generalizations, often from pretty limited information. And crucially, especially for everyday life, it connects all this to Kahneman and Tversky's famous work on heuristics and biases, fitting it into this dual process structure for judgment and decision making.
Okay, so let's get to the core then,
yeah,
the framework itself. You said two types of processing.
That's right. Early in the book, he lays it out. Pretty much everything we think or decide boils down to these two types.
Let's call them.
Yeah.
Maybe autopilot and pilot. Or maybe autopilot and supervisor.
Yeah, autopilot works. That's type one processing. It's the default. It is incredibly fast. It's automatic, associative, linking things together quickly, totally effortless, and runs largely unconsciously.
So gut feelings, first impressions.
Yeah.
That's type one.
Exactly. It's got huge capacity, handles all that incoming sensory stuff, runs our routines, like driving to work without really thinking about how you're driving.
Okay. And the supervisor then? Type two processing. That's the one we feel like is us, right? Our conscious thoughts.
Precisely. Type two is the expensive one. It's slow, requires control, takes real effort. It works in sequence one thing at a time. And here's the crucial part. It's really limited by our working memory capacity. This is where you do your deliberate planning, your complex problem solving, mental simulations, conscious reasoning.
Okay, but if type one is so fast and efficient, you called it a survival hack.
Yeah.
Why did we even need type two? Isn't speed the most important thing for survival? Why evolve this slow, energy-guzzling system?
Ah, that's the paradox, isn't it? Type 1 is fantastic for familiar situations, for quick pattern recognition, but it falls down when things get abstract or novel, or when the obvious intuitive answer is actually wrong.
So how do they work together?
The model Evans often uses is the default interventionist model. Basically, type 1 spits out a quick default response, then type 2 might step in to check it, override it, or correct it. But, and this is a big but, only if you have the motivation, the time, and crucially, the mental energy, the cognitive capacity to engage it.
Like the cognitive fuel.
Yeah.
And that tension explains so many of those frustrating moments.
Yeah.
Like belief bias. Evans talks about that with deductive reasoning, right?
Yes, syllogisms show it perfectly. You can have an argument that's logically flawed, completely invalid, but the conclusion sounds believable, something you agree with, like all things made of plants are healthy. Cigarettes are made of plants, therefore cigarettes are healthy.
Okay, clearly wrong.
Clearly wrong. But if the conclusion was something agreeable, say all flowers are beautiful, roses are flowers, therefore roses are beautiful, even if the structure had a hidden flaw, people are much more likely to say, yep, sounds logical, because the conclusion feels right.
So type one is just screaming, yes, I believe this conclusion. And that feeling makes it really hard work for type two to step back, ignore the content, and just analyze the abstract logical structure.
Exactly. It takes significant type two effort to override that strong feeling of rightness from a believable conclusion. We default to believability over logical validity. Mm-hmm. It's easier.
And we see a similar kind of systematic error in things like conditional reasoning. Which brings us to the Wesson selection task. That's the famous one.
Oh, yeah. Classic. So imagine four cards. They have something on both sides. You see A, K, 4, 7. The rule is, if a card has a vowel on one side, then it must have an even number on the other side. Which cards do you absolutely need to turn over to check if the rule is being broken?
Okay. Well, A, obviously. Got to check if there's an even number. Most people get that. And I guess people often pick 4. To see if there's a vowel.
Right. They pick A and 4, but picking 4 doesn't actually test the rule. If it has a consonant, the rule isn't broken. The critical card they miss is the 7.
The 7. Ah, because if that has a vowel on the other side, the rule is definitely broken.
Precisely. It's the potential falsifier. The reason people fail is likely down to type 1 heuristics. Things like matching bias were just drawn to the items mentioned in the rule, vowels and even numbers, and also a strong confirmation bias. We instinctively look for things that confirm the rule, not things that might disprove it.
Wow. That says a lot about how we argue, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We're trying to prove ourselves right, not find the actual truth. But wasn't there a twist, like if you change the context?
Yes. If you frame the exact same logical problem in a real-world social context, like checking IDs in a bar, if a person is drinking beer, they must be over 21. People solve it almost instantly. They know they need to check the beer drinker and the person who looks under 21.
It shows the type 2 logical machinery is there.
It's there, but it gets triggered much more easily when type 1 recognizes a familiar, meaningful situation. Context is key.
Okay, let's connect this more directly to the mental shortcuts we use every day. Judgment under uncertainty.
Yeah.
This dual process idea really helps explain those heuristics, right? Like the availability heuristic.
Absolutely. Availability is pure type 1 efficiency. If you can easily recall examples of something, maybe a dramatic plane crash you saw on the news, your type 1 system assumes it must be common.
Even if, statistically, it's incredibly rare.
Exactly. Ease of recall becomes a proxy for frequency. It's a useful shortcut most of the time, but easily biased by vivid media coverage or recent events. You overestimate the risk because the example is so available in your mind.
And then there's representativeness,
yeah,
where we judge likelihood based on how much something resembles a stereotype.
Uh-huh. We assess probability by comparing something to our mental prototype of a category, often ignoring the actual base rates, the background statistical frequency.
The classic example is the Linda the bank teller problem, isn't it?
That's the one. You get a description of Linda. She's bright, concerned with social justice, participated in protests, etc. And then people are asked, which is more probable? A, Linda is a bank teller, or B, Linda is a bank teller and is active in the feminist movement.
And most people choose B, right?
Yeah.
Even though, logically, a single condition, being a bank teller, has to be more probable than two conditions combined, bank teller A and D feminist.
Correct. They choose B because the description feels more representative of a feminist bank teller than just a generic bank teller. It's type 1 matching the description to a prototype, overriding basic probability logic handled by type 2. These heuristics are efficient, fast, but yeah, predictably flawed.
So if we zoom out from the specific examples, what are the really big core messages Evans wants us to take away from all this?
Okay, I think the first, maybe the most crucial, is just internalizing this dual process core. Understanding that our thinking isn't one unified thing. It's this constant negotiation between these two systems.
Right. And reflecting on that, it explains that feeling of internal conflict, doesn't it? When you know the rational type 2 answer, but that easy, intuitive type 1 pull is so strong.
Exactly. Second big theme, biases as adaptive features. This is quite radical. Not seeing them just as errors, but as the sort of predictable outcomes of a type 1 system that evolved for fast, good enough decisions in our ancestral past.
Like the Russell in the grass example. Better to jump back 100 times from nothing than miss the one time it's a predator. That bias keeps you alive.
Precisely. Better safe than sorry was often ecologically rational. Third, Evans really pushes us to think about rationality defined by goals or instrumental rationality. He distinguishes it from just following logic rules perfectly. Normative rationality.
So being rational isn't just about logic. It's about achieving what you want to achieve.
Yes. Sometimes making a quick, imperfect type 1 decision is more rational instrumentally if the situation demands speed and action, a logically perfect decision that comes too late. That's not rational in terms of achieving your goal.
That's a really useful distinction. Okay, what else?
And finally, maybe the most sobering one, the primacy of belief. He argues a lot of our reasoning, especially our conscious type 2 reasoning, is actually motivated reasoning.
Meaning, we use reason to defend what we already believe, not to find the truth.
Often, yes. If our goal is to protect our identity or our group affiliation, type 2 acts more like a lawyer, finding evidence to support our case, rather than an impartial judge weighing all sides. Understanding this is, well, it's vital for making sense of disagreements, especially in politics or social issues today.
Yeah, you can really see that playing out. The book must have some powerful lines summarizing these ideas.
Oh, definitely. The core ideas really stick with you.
I remember one, paraphrased, of course, about rationality itself. Something like, judging human reasoning as irrational just because it doesn't follow formal logic misses the point. Real rationality is about successfully navigating the messy, uncertain world we actually live in.
That's a great one. It puts logic in its place as a tool, not the ultimate benchmark. And another powerful one, maybe slightly paraphrased, on beliefs. Our reasoning is often the servant of our prior convictions, not their master.
Oof, yeah. That explains a lot about why changing minds is so hard. We use our smarts to justify, not necessarily to learn.
And one more on the limits of that conscious mind, type 2. Conscious, deliberate reasoning is the superpower of the human mind. But it's a superpower with a strict energy limit. It's like a small spotlight in this vast darkness of automatic processing. We have to choose where to point it wisely.
That's brilliant. It emphasizes that type 2 is precious, right? We can't use it for everything. We have to conserve that mental energy.
We really do. So, okay, the practical side. Knowing all this, how can you, the listener, actually use it? How do we make better choices?
Well, for better decision making, especially on big things, the first step seems to be just awareness. Recognizing that type 1 gut feeling when it hits hard.
Right. If you feel that strong emotional pull, maybe loss aversion kicking in, or getting swayed by how a choice is framed, you have to consciously hit the brakes. Force type 2 to engage.
How? Like, literally make a checklist. Or play devil's advocate against your own gut feeling.
Exactly. Structured approaches. Seeking outside opinions. Anything that forces that slower, more deliberate analysis instead of just going with the flow of type 1.
Okay. And what about dealing with all the noise out there? Navigating misinformation. Confirmation bias is everywhere.
Evans's work points to a really practical mental habit. Instead of just asking what proves me right, actively, deliberately ask yourself, what evidence would prove me wrong?
Forcing the falsification mindset.
Yes. It makes type 2 do the hard work of considering alternatives, not just cherry-picking confirming bits.
Right. This applies in professional settings too, right? Professional de-biasing.
Absolutely. Especially in fields like medicine, finance, law, anywhere with high stakes. Individuals will always have biases. So organizations need systems. Things like mandatory second opinions, standardized protocols, checklists. Basically, building external structures that compensate for the known weaknesses and shortcuts of individual type 1 thinking under pressure. The system has to help the mind.
So, reflecting on this deep dive, what was the biggest thing for you? What felt most valuable from Evan's perspective?
For me, it really crystallizes the idea that rationality is a skill, It's not just something you have or you don't. It's about developing that metacognitive awareness, that sensitivity to when your intuition might be leading you astray, and then knowing how to deploy that limited, effortful type 2 thinking effectively. It's something you can practice and get better at.
Yeah, I agree with that. For me, the biggest thing was maybe the intellectual humility it encourages. Realizing that myself, my thinking, is this ongoing negotiation between this fast, often biased system and this slower, logical one. It makes you maybe a bit more forgiving of others' irrationality and hopefully a bit more watchful of your own. It's complex in there.
It really is. And maybe a final thought to leave everyone with, something Evans emphasizes. He argues that the most powerful, perhaps unique function of our conscious type 2 mind isn't just logic, it's hypothetical thinking.
Hypothetical thinking.
The ability to detach from the here and now, to simulate what ifs, to imagine alternative possibilities, future scenarios, consequences of actions, really run those mental models.
That's fascinating. So the question for you listening is, how often do you truly engage that simulation power? How often do you step back and really explore the what ifs before acting? Or do you usually just let that quick, easy type 1 answer carry the day?
It's powerful stuff.
Yeah.
Thinking about the future, not just reacting to the present.
Definitely something to chew on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.